The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, if everyone
can take a seat. Get down to
Good morning. I'm really apologetic for starting the symposium a little bit late, but the traffic is just being crazy for some of us who live far away. I'm Chloe Farber, and I'm the executive director of the Kaplan Policy Program, which is part of the program on law and government. And it's our pleasure to present this symposium today on healthcare disparities in conjunction with the student organization, which is called the Health Law and Justice Initiative, and the student publication, which is called the Health Law and Policy Brief. And at your tables, you have the latest issue of the Health Law and Policy Brief. And we have two people who are seated at the dais who are representatives of both organizations. Katie Pinto is the Secretary, Vice President, Treasurer, many, many hats of the Health Law and Justice Initiative. And Jill Carter Moore is one of the co-editors in chief of the Health Law and Policy Brief. So I'd like them just to say a couple of words from their seats about their organizations and how we put this program together.
Sure. Once again, I'm Katie Caniglio, and I'm representing the Health Law and Justice Initiative. And I'd also like to recognize Bethany Brown, who is the president of the Health Law and Justice Initiative and has been integrally involved in planning this event. Our group is one of the only student organizations focusing on health law. And this year, we've decided to take a much more active approach than previous years, and we've put together events that will help spark an interest in health law and also help already interested students develop professionally. Earlier in the year, we hosted a career panel entitled How Health Law Will Save Your Career, and we had the hiring partner from Akin Gump, we had a representative from the Brookings Institution, and we're really proud of how active this organization has become this year. We think that it's a really exciting time to be a health law student with the reform potentially on the horizon, and at least health law is more on the minds of the American public, and it seems that health law is a great avenue for law students these days. So we're going to continue to be active and create events that will, support our health-minded law students.
First of all, I don't want Katie to shortchange herself. She's also on the editorial board of the Health Law and Policy Brief, and she was our representative for organizing this symposium. The brief was started, I would say, about 3 years ago with the focus of really having a publication that focused on solely health law issues as opposed to kind of more human rights issues, which we have a lot of briefs here, as students may know, that focus more on that. We're really proud of the publication. Our most recent publication actually has a huge section on our symposium from last year, which was on women's healthcare issues. So this symposium will be featured in the fall edition for next year, the transcription of it. So yeah, we're really excited and happy you're all here.
Well, welcome, Dane. And as Katie and Jocelyn leave the dais, and what I'd like to do is bring up the panelists for our first panel and the moderator, who is also active in the Health Law and Policy Brief and the Health Law and Justice Initiative, Walla Blagate. So if you would like to come up, we'll do the switch.
Everyone. I see that we don't have all of our panelists here as of now, but if and when those come in, I will go ahead and introduce the new panelists as they come in. But for right now, I'll be introducing Mara Yodelman and Julia Pierce. And we are happy to have you all. This is the racial disparity panel. Let me begin. Mara Yodelman has worked with the National Health Law Program since August 2000 on issues including Medicaid, language access, racial and ethnic disparities, and data collection. She is director of the National Language Access Advocacy Project, funded by the California Endowment to Increase Awareness of Language Access Issues at the federal level. She coordinates a national coalition to develop a consensus-driven agenda to improve policies and funding for individuals with limited English proficiency. She also authored numerous publications on language access issues. Ms. Yodelman also chairs the Certification Commission for Healthcare Interpreters, whose mission is to develop and administer a national, valid, credible, vendor-neutral certification program for healthcare interpreters. Prior to working with the National Health Law Program, she completed a teaching fellowship at Georgetown University Law Center's Federal Legislation Clinic. She earned her JD with the Boston University School of Law and her LLM in advocacy from Georgetown University Law Center. Welcome. Now we'll introduce Ms. Pierce. She comes here representing the Department of Health and Human Service, Office of General Counsel, Public Health Division, Indian Health Service Branch. She served as a licensed radiologic technologist at the Navy Hospital in the Navy Reserves from 1988 to 1996. Ms. Pierce worked as a radiologic technologist at the Medical College of Virginia and a community hospital while attending college and law school. While attending the University of Virginia School of Law, she served as the president of the Native American Student Union. After graduating in 1998, she joined the Indian Health Service Branch of the Office of General Counsel, where she served as team leader, negotiating consistency among teams that negotiated the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act contracts with Indian tribes. She was instrumental in transferring over $2 billion from the federal government to tribes annually before turning this task over to her counterpart, Hillary Keeler. She has been involved with litigation at every level of the federal court system, including the Supreme Court. And she has also served on the team that developed regulations required by Title V of the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, traveling throughout the country for over a year to meet various tribes for consultation. Last year, she completed the Department of Health and Human Service 18-month Senior Executive Service Candidate Development Program and was certified as an SES member in 2009. Thank you, Ms. And now we also have Mr. Leonard Rubenstein. He is a renowned advocate for human rights and medical ethics. He is currently a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health Center for Public Health and Human Rights and a Center for a Livable Future. He is the former executive director of Physicians for Human Rights and was recently a Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. He co-authored a report on the disparities in quality of care and application of international human rights law and brought the issues to the UN Racism Conference in 2001. He has an expertise in international human rights law and its connection to disaggregated data collection. Thank you, Mr. Rubenstein. Well, we will begin with, and I think we can introduce in that case, we have our full panel, and we have Ms. Gina Wood is Deputy Director of the Joint Center's Health Policy Institute. She is a team leader supporting the implementation strategy for Health Policy Institute programs, public and private sector partnerships, communication, research and policy analysis, and resource development. Ms. Wood has an exemplary public service background spanning 20 years in state and federal level positions. In light of her prior experience in the legislative and executive branches of Oregon state government, then Governor Jim Hodges of South Carolina asked her to join his cabinet as director of the Department of Juvenile Justice. Subsequently, she worked as a director by she was confirmed as director by the South Carolina State Senate. At the federal level, she served as staff director of the Coordinating Council on Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, chaired by then Attorney General Janet Reno, and comprised of leaders of key federal agencies. During her tenure, she led major interagency initiatives, which granted the support of the United States Congress and a number of foundations. Ms. Wood is currently affiliated with the Women of Color Policy Network at the Robert F. Wagner School of Public Service at New York University and serves on the board of directors at Crittenden Services of Greater Washington. She is also the member of the Advocacy Committee of the Juvenile Justice for the Commonwealth of Virginia. In addition, she serves as the trustee on two national boards, the Coalition of Juvenile Justice, where she chairs the Ethic and Cultural Diversity Committee, and the National Crittenden Foundation. Ms. Wood holds a bachelor's degree in communications from the University of New Zealand. Thank you, Ms. Wood. We will begin this panel by each of the panelists discussing some of the major problems they see with health disparities in the United States, and what of you, many of you are representing different organizations, some of the work maybe the organizations that you have done to contribute to health disparities, and quickly talk about the trends or the myths that many folks believe that are problems with health disparities, and how, you know, ways that we can look at it in a different way. So we'll start with the
I'm only standing so I can do the PowerPoint, which hopefully I can figure out as we go. So good morning, and thank you for inviting me. Just make sure this will work. Perfect. What I want to do is talk to you guys about language access issues. I'll tell you first briefly about my organization, because we do a lot more than language access. Walk you through some of the issues surrounding language access, and then talk about some of the work we were doing on health reform to try and remedy some of these issues. So NHELPR, the National Health Law Program, is a national nonprofit law firm. Our overriding mission is working on behalf of low and limited income individuals and improving access to and quality of care. We do a lot on civil and human rights, and that's where our health disparities work comes in. And I've been working on language access issues ever since I got to NHELPR about 9.5 years ago. We've been receiving funding for about 7 years now from the California Endowment for our language access work, and in large part this supports a broad national coalition of stakeholders who can work together on areas of consensus to improve language access. And so we've actually brought together folks who used to be at OAB, many of the healthcare provider associations, the advocates, the healthcare accrediting organizations, interpreting associations, companies that provide interpreters and provide translated materials, and others to work together to try to raise awareness at the federal level and improve policies related to language access. In terms of the demographics and what I'm talking about, in the U.S., over 55 million people speak a language other than English at home. In healthcare, we sort of say that if you speak English less than very well, you would be considered LEP, or limited English proficient, and you are likely going to need assistance communicating with healthcare providers. So you might need help in the oral communication, and so you might need a provider who's bilingual, or you might need an interpreter who can actually interpret the conversations happening between providers and patients. You might also need help understanding written materials, and so there's a lot of materials that need to be translated for these folks. So about 9% of the population is limited English proficient, or LEP, for healthcare purposes. In terms of what this means in the healthcare provider setting, about 80% of hospitals are seeing LEP patients at least monthly. And these statistics are from national surveys we actually funded with some of our partners in this national coalition. So hospitals across the country, it's not just the, you know, big states where lots of immigrants are. It's no longer sort of Illinois, California, New York, New Jersey, where the traditional pockets have been. But it really is 80% of hospitals across the country are encountering patients who have limited English proficiency at least monthly. The same statistic holds true for small practices, general internal medicine physicians. And then we did a study with the community health centers, and the statistic was even more relevant, that 84% of these clinics are providing daily care to patients who have limited English proficiency. And so this is a widespread national issue that is really overlooked in a lot of ways. And there's lots of documented research on the problems that people face when they have limited English proficiency. One of them is a very well-documented lawsuit out of Florida. There actually was a $71 million settlement that resulted when a young man was left quadriplegic after a misinterpreted word. And then we have lots of other horrible stories, such as the one I have on the slide here. A six-week-old infant was admitted for a barbiturate overdose that was caused by a dosing error because a limited English proficient mother did not understand the medication instructions that were given by the doctor, and the instructions were only available in English, they weren't translated. So, lots of issues, lots of stories, lots of horrible consequences. We actually are doing research right now on malpractice in language access. This has always been a question for us. We always get the question, well, are there more lawsuits? You know, can we give more evidence about the consequences of poor language access? And so we actually have been working with a malpractice insurer in California and looking through their closed claims. And so in about a month, we'll be releasing an issue brief that documents a lot of malpractice cases where language barriers were at least one piece of the puzzle. So we're really trying to sort of build the case legally in addition to the horrible stories that result. On the legal side, we actually have a strong legal case for requirements to provide language services. There has been a law in place since 1964, Title VI, that says anyone who takes federal funds can't discriminate on the basis of race, color, or national origin. And the Supreme Court and the federal agencies like HHS have said language can be a proxy for national origin. So if you take federal dollars, you can't discriminate based on language, which means you should be providing meaningful access to these patients in federally funded programs. Okay, so we're talking about healthcare. Virtually every single healthcare provider is taking some federal dollars. They're participating in Medicaid, in the Children's Health Insurance Program, in Medicare. They're taking research funds from Centers for Disease Control or the National Institutes for Health. Federal dollars touch virtually all aspects of healthcare. So there really is an expectation that healthcare providers should be providing language access. They should be providing interpreters and they should be translating materials. But the vast majority are really still not doing that, and that's why we still have significant health disparities. In addition to this federal law, many states actually have lots of state laws. And so we actually did a national survey a couple of years ago looking at all 50 states and identifying statutes and regulations that address language access in healthcare. And every single state has at least two laws. And some have extremely comprehensive laws, and some have just, you know, minor provisions here and there. Excuse me. We also saw some recent trends, and so there is starting to be more attention at the state level to address issues of language access. So we've seen some new requirements come up in the education of health profession students, or in the continuing education for healthcare providers, and putting in requirements that there be education and training about cultural competency and about language access. We've also seen some states start to develop standards for healthcare interpreters. There's been a lot of problems that many providers don't understand, that grabbing a family member to interpret is not really the best way to go. That there are lots of problems when family members, friends, children in particular, or even just folks who say that they're bilingual, when they're pulled in to interpret, they don't know how to interpret. They might be bilingual, but they might not know the medical terminology. They might not know how to interpret. Ethics, confidentiality, lots of issues arise. So some states are starting to look at the issues of competency or certification standards for interpreters. We've also seen some additional requirements being put in places mostly led by California on private insurers. So folks who aren't taking federal funds and aren't subject to that federal law I just mentioned, but states can actually impose and say as a private insurer, you have to provide language access and make sure that your network providers are providing language access. So real briefly, I gave you some of the statistics, but who's considered LEP, or limited English proficient? And this is basically anyone who can't speak, read, write, or understand English at a level that permits effective interaction with health and social service agencies. What does this mean in practice? I said it basically is you can't speak English very well. Healthcare, as you all know, is exceptionally complicated. And I've had a doctor friend say, when you're dealing with healthcare, you're not just dealing with English and Spanish. but you're adding on two more languages, medical English and medical Spanish, or whatever the other language is. And so there's additional issues, and that's why lots of people likely may need assistance in interacting in healthcare, even though they can effectively interact in English in other settings. So, what have we been doing? We tried to do a lot to improve language access and address some of the disparities issues through health reform. You all know health reform is stalled, but we still are optimistic. There were three main asks that members of our national coalition put together. And so this is what I wanted to talk to you about this morning, was sort of how we were trying to influence and address disparities through federal legislation. So one of them was to give states more money to provide interpreters in Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. And these are the two health, public health programs that primarily are for low-income individuals and children. And so states can pay for interpreters in these programs, but many of them don't because it costs them about 50 cents on the dollar. So we were trying to increase the federal payments to states and look at that as a way to sort of incentivize states to doing more to provide language access in public health programs. The second piece we were trying to address is Medicare. Medicare, again, is a program that mostly serves the elderly and people with disabilities. And Medicare doesn't pay for language services. So we were trying to get the ball rolling in Medicare. We couldn't move to, we wanted to have legislation that said Medicare is to pay for language services, but that was going to cost $2.5 billion. So we kind of realized that wasn't going to happen in health reform with everything else and all the other cost pressures. So instead, we wanted to start the ball rolling by doing a one-year study to look at how Medicare could pay for language services. And then a three-year demonstration program to start gathering some data and give some funding out to Medicare providers to explore how this could actually work in practice. And then the third piece was, you all probably have heard about the exchange or the gateway. It sort of morphed into, the Senate and the House bills are not calling it the exchange, the place where people who don't get insurance through a public health program or through their employer can buy private health insurance, and some of those folks will get subsidies. So we were, again, trying to put requirements on plans participating in the exchange to provide culturally and linguistically appropriate services. So those were sort of the three main asks that we had. In terms of what we got in the Senate, we weren't able to get anything in Medicare and Medicaid. There isn't a real requirement for the exchange to provide language access, unfortunately. There are some requirements of developing standards for providing summary of benefits and coverage, you know, those things we all get in the mail, that must consider cultural language issues. But again, the Senate bill was pretty weak on this. In terms of the House, we actually were much more effective. So that Medicare study and demo was in, the increased money for Medicaid was in, some money was going to be given to hospitals to prevent readmissions of patients, and that could be used to pay for translation and interpreters. And then in the exchange, the House actually got a number of provisions. So it was going to pretty much require culturally and linguistically appropriate services by these private plans providing services. What that actually meant in practice was going to have to be addressed administratively, but at least it was trying to put some requirements in place. It also was going to require plans to use plain language, which really helps more folks in LEP because of health literacy issues. But certainly, if you can get to plain, simple language in English, and then you translate it, it's a lot easier to translate and more people can understand it. So that's sort of where we were when health reform stalled. We're still optimistic, as I said, and we're waiting to see what may happen and which of the final provisions may make it in. But since health reform hasn't happened, we're also exploring administrative actions. And again, this is where members of our coalition have been working together for a number of years. But we are really trying to get the federal government, and particularly the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which oversees Medicaid and Medicare, to step up. And so we'd like Medicare, for example, to translate the forms so that providers across the country don't have to do it themselves. We'd like to see them create a clearinghouse for materials to assist providers, and then put in requirements for language access in policies and regulations and in requests for proposal. So in terms of our next steps, we're waiting for developments on health reform. We're looking at other legislative options to see if we can move some of these issues forward and exploring more administrative opportunities as well. And then we continue to do research to help add to this, because the more we can sort of document the needs and the disparities, the more likely it is that policymakers can be responsive and start to move this along. So real briefly, that's the quick overview on language access and health reform.
She only wants me to talk for about 10 minutes. I may or may not do that. I have a handout, you guys. And yeah, thank you. Just a one-pager. I'm Julia Pierce. I'm an attorney for the Indian Health Service. We also have some language barrier problems, but there are 564 different languages that we're dealing with. The Indian Health Service provides the health services to the 564 tribes, federally recognized tribes, in America and Alaska, which is of course part of America, but when you're up there with the native people, sometimes they think that they're in a totally different country. We have some interesting barriers to health care that are seen by other rural communities, but not quite in the same way. The IHS provides health services to 1.9 million of the nation's estimated 3.3 million Indian people. Many of those people live in Alaska, in tiny villages, in extraordinarily remote and isolated communities. While IHS strives for the maximum tribal involvement in the health services we provide, there are budget limitations that make that challenging. Now, the tribal-federal relationship has been defined by case law and statute as a political relationship, not a racial relationship, which allows a lot of the work the Indian Health Service does and a lot of the hiring the Indian Health Service does to escape the Title VI affirmative action laws. Many of you may not know that there is actually an Indian Health Service preferential hiring policy, which is established by statute. Congress found many years ago that Indian people related culturally and obviously better to other Indian people, who they felt had a better understanding of where they were from and some of the challenges they're facing. Now, what becomes interesting and also builds on the previous presentation is that the Indian Health Service finds that there's a basic problem between the federal and the state relationship, and that often the states think the tribes are separate states within their states. And the states believe that tribal people are not eligible for their programs, that the federal government is providing all of them. And of course, Indian people are citizens of their states as well as their individual tribes, and they are eligible in the same way everybody else is. But that's a challenge we have to overcome. Indian people have long experienced lower health status than the rest of the racial populations in America. On average, the life expectancy of Indian people is about 4.5 years less than the U.S. all races population. American Indians and Alaska Natives die at a higher rate than other Americans from tuberculosis, about 750% higher, alcoholism 550% higher, diabetes 190% higher, unintentional injuries, 150% higher, and homicide, 100% higher. There are reasons for that. A lot of those reasons we've been examining for years, but when you really start looking at why there are such healthcare disparities, you have to look at history. People are in remote locations. There's no economic opportunity. There was segregation up until recent times. So people have not had the same educational opportunities. And if they want to live on or near the reservation, as I said, even if they've gone away and gotten educated, there's not going to be an economic opportunity to do so. Many people make that decision to come back and to deal with the ramifications of not being able to find a job in their field or a sustainable job. But all of that lends to a healthcare disparity, because healthcare is not just are healthcare services available to me. It's more of a holistic approach, especially in Native communities. Am I able to have the emotional well-being, the intellectual stimulation to allow me to feel worthwhile? If I come back to my community, am I able to sustain myself if I don't come back to my community, if I lose that part of my culture? These are things that the Indian Health Service tries to look at in a holistic manner. We actually also support Native medicines. So we're the federal agency that will, you know, support the alternative medicine. There are things in our contracts with Native peoples that none of us even understand, because we're not allowed to know these sorts of practices because they're only available to those tribal members. And it would be sacrosanct to them, and therefore they're not allowed to discuss them when we're negotiating what sort of health services they'll be provided. Now, while they're in rural communities, they're not the same rural communities that some of us grew up in. They're rural in the most extreme sense, where many people don't have sanitation and running water. So you're looking at disproportionate poverty and often discrimination in the delivery of the health care that's available to them. Because in these places, Indians aren't revered as they often are on television or the movies. There's a lot of racial discrimination, a lot of cultural misunderstandings, and a lot of ridicule for people who prefer to stay true to their cultural and traditional practices. So these are the sorts of things that lend to disparity in health care that aren't really openly discussed unless you set up a form. And that's what the Indian Health Service and, for the larger part, the Department of Health and Human Services tries to do. So we have a policy of consultation with tribes on basically everything that we can afford to consult on. Now, we're not an entitlement program in the sense that there's a never-ending well of funding under the department, and we can provide the amount of services that tribal people in the country would rightfully deserve. We have a $4 billion budget, and as I said, we're serving about 1.9 million people in very remote locations. We're building hospitals and clinics. About 57% of the Indian population is being served by basically, I think it's 45 hospitals and 600 clinics. We're providing those services either directly in places where tribes are not able to provide for themselves, or in places where tribes have gotten a bit savvier and have the expertise through the Indian Self-Determination Act contracts, which means that a tribe takes the funding the government would have spent and they provide the services themselves. For us, that's a win. That's when we can actually see the good work that the Indian Health Service is doing and continue with the idea that this is a government-to-government relationship. You probably, if any of you have had any Indian law courses, are familiar with the Worcester v. Georgia case, which established Native tribes as dependent domestic nations. That's an interesting title. It kind of sets up a guardian-ward relationship, which in its own way is a bit paternalistic. But if you look at it in terms of this is a situation where the government is attempting to pay back a debt that's owed, it's not as paternalistic. And we are sincerely trying to make tribes get to a level where self-determination means for everybody that a tribe can decide to let the government run its own healthcare operation, and that that's as much of a statement of self-governance as the tribe running it itself. Now, as I said, we're underfunded. $4 billion seems like a lot, but it's not when you're in healthcare. So what we've done to try to make up for some of this disparity is to look into partnerships with not only other agencies within our department, but other departments at large. The Department of Housing has an Indian housing program. They're also responsible for sanitation in houses. That's something that the Indian Health Service is looking at. The Department of Justice has the Rural Justice Programs. They provide many of the things that you wouldn't think about as necessarily related to healthcare, like who provides guards for the hospital. That's not us. We don't have the funding. We try to work with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They have all the social programs. So we've set up partnerships not only throughout the government, but with private entities. Many of you may not know that Nike has designed a shoe for Indian people. Now, admittedly, it looks like a huge, hideous block, but they found that many Indian people who have diabetes are also large. There are reasons for that, reasons that deal with poverty and the food that the government gave to Indian people on reservations, but it has led to a larger, wider, bigger foot. So Nike has, in conjunction with the Indian Health Service, provided the shoe, which is actually being used by the Indian Health Service. The purpose of us entering into those sorts of partnerships, not only to get specifically designed shoe wear, but also to encourage exercise and to try to get out there and show that there are private outside organizations that actually care what's happening to people's health on reservations. So they have a secondary effect. Besides us being able to say, look, if you do this for us, you will not only supplement our budget, not in a way that violates any sort of appropriation law, but it will also show Indian people that there are people that care, that it's not simply a situation where the rest of the world has forgotten that Indian people exist. So we are trying to enter into as many partnerships as possible. We actually have been encouraged to do this by the highest levels of government. President Obama has recently reissued the executive order on consultation, saying that if there's anything that the federal government is going to do that affects Indian people, they need to consult with Indian people. So it's a very interesting place to work, because you're not only dealing with a section of society that most people know very little about, but it's a section of society that most people, if they really read history, would agree have not been treated particularly fairly, and that amends need to be made. So it's a really, really interesting and worthwhile thing to do. And I was also told to put a plug in case anybody's interested in coming to our office. So we do take interns.
Good opportunity to grab a cup of coffee. For those of you who came in a little bit earlier, we're taking some juice.
Well, you have to do it by soup. First of all, it's really important to have this meeting, and I'm really pleased to be here. In 10 minutes, I just wanted to say a few things. One is that when we talk about disparities, we need to distinguish at least three kinds of disparities. There are actually more. There are issues about language and other aspects. There are three fundamental aspects of disparities. One is disparities in access. And that's what the debate in this country has been about for the last year, about disparities in access. We know that not only do we have tens of millions of uninsured people, but African Americans and other minorities are disproportionately uninsured. The second disparities in health status. And we've had this supposedly national effort to eliminate health disparities by 2010. So we'll see how we're doing on that. And the third is disparities in quality. I just want to give you a little data about those last two. We know so much about access, I didn't even want to use the time to talk about that. And then I want to talk about how we have to think about these problems in a new way. So we made this major effort, okay, can you all see this? A major effort to eliminate disparities in health status. And as it happened, it was just very convenient, there was a study that appeared this very month in the American Journal of Public Health that tells us how we're doing and not doing. You see different measures of status, and in the two columns are the percentage differences between whites and African Americans on each of the levels in 1990 and then in 2005. In 2005, if it's in yellow, that means there's been an improvement, and if it's in red, it means it's gotten worse. The first thing you need to notice, though, I'm not going to go them one by one, that just in terms of absolutes, these are huge disparities. I mean, if you take all-cause disparities, 35% difference. That is, African Americans have 30 die from all causes younger, 35% more than white. And in each one of these are significant numbers. The only one where whites do worse is in suicide. And you see that despite this supposedly enormous national effort, at least half of the indicators have gotten worse since 1990. That is, disparities in health status have gotten worse when measured by these various mortality indicators. And even those that have gotten better, they're still not close. They're better than they were, but the only one that's even getting close to zero is lung cancer. So we have this major problem, a stunning problem in disparities in health status. And the first slide was about mortality. These are three other kind of very fundamental health indicators: low birth weight, prenatal care in the first trimester, and tuberculosis. You see the tuberculosis based the enormous numbers. Those are hundreds of percentage points difference, 700 difference. And once again, that's getting worse. The disparity is getting worse. So that's where we are in health status. It's a very sobering set of data after this long, decades-long discussion and commitment, or supposed commitment, to reducing health disparities based on race. You could have a whole other slide based on ethnicity. We don't have time for that. How about quality? Quality. People talk about quality of care even less, because we assume that everybody gets the same quality of care. At least, it may not be good quality, but it's not going to be different based on race or ethnicity. But there now are hundreds, probably 1,000 studies, all in peer-reviewed journals, showing that on any kind of health care offered in this country, African Americans and other ethnic minorities get worse quality of care than whites. And you can see it, you see things like fewer referral for renal transplants, less adequate pain medication for cancer, inferior HIV care, fewer admissions for cardiac care units. Now, some of this you might think is attributable to access to health insurance. But then, if you look at a Medicare population where everybody has the same access because they're all eligible for Medicare, this was the Medicare Plus Choice program. It was 400,000 enrollees, 294 plans. And yet, in that study, this was now some years ago, but the study found that on indicators across many, many different kinds of care, mental health, cardiac care, cancer, psychiatric care, that African Americans got worse care. Now, for a long time, there have been efforts to address this problem through legislation, through the Office of Minority Health, through various very modest legislative, administrative, and professional efforts to address the problem, you see it hasn't been very successful. In this year's healthcare legislation, there are more modest efforts. But just to show you how modest this has been, it's been about a decade since people have been trying to get good collection data, good data on disparities that communities could have access to. So, for example, in the Medicare program, it would be perfectly possible, instead of having to have researchers pour through data, that this would data would be publicly available so that we would know both access would be, forget about that, based on having access, but you would have data on what the kind of care people are getting and what the outcomes are. It's all available and could be organized and distributed. But for almost 10 years, legislation has not made it through Congress to require that. In the healthcare bills, there are provisions to assure that we collect data so that people can know, not just on a national level, not just in very kind of large data sets, but in broken down by city, state, and community. People would know what's going on in their communities and could organize around that. But we don't yet have that disaggregated data. And we hope, if there is a healthcare bill, that will remain in. But that just shows what a problem we have. The second problem we have is how we think about this. And this is where I want to turn to, you're all law students, right? I want you to think about law in a different way. In our culture and in our legal system, we've had wonderful civil rights laws. And our civil rights laws, I don't know how many of you have taken civil rights law, but they are anti-discrimination laws. And they're all written in basically the same way. They say, if you are discriminated against, you may have a claim. You can file an administrative claim, you can file a lawsuit. So thou shalt not discriminate, and if you have your rights violated, you can sue. Let's look at a whole different way of looking at this problem. International human rights law takes a very different approach to it, conceptually. It doesn't say, don't discriminate. If you discriminate, you have a right to sue. It says the state, the government, has a responsibility to eliminate discrimination. It's very different from our concept of civil rights law, even though we think it kind of says that. Civil rights laws are very individual claim-based. This says you have a responsibility to eliminate discrimination. It's incredible that our civil rights laws actually don't really say that. They don't say there is a responsibility to eliminate discrimination. Now, so how many of you know that the United States is a party to the Convention of Elimination of All Forms of Race Discrimination? Anybody know that? Most of you learned something today. We are. The U.S. is infamous for not adhering or signing or ratifying human rights treaties. We haven't signed ratified the Women's Convention. We haven't ratified the Convention on Rights of the Child. We haven't ratified the Land Rights Treaty. We haven't ratified the Cluster of Munitions Treaty. All kinds of human rights treaties the U.S. hasn't ratified. But here's one that we have. The Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And this is not, like all human rights treaties in the U.S., it's not self-executing. But it is a conceptual approach. When I mean self-executing, you can't sue based on this. And sometimes it's hard to talk to law students or lawyers because they always want to have a remedy. But in human rights, we're often without remedies. In fact, one of my colleagues says the reason the human rights community, the human rights movement exists is because it's been a failure of law, that we have to mobilize in other ways, and then we can develop legal remedies. But I think if we look at this issue conceptually and mobilize around it, we can say the U.S. government has a responsibility that it is not meeting to eliminate racial disparities and ethnic disparities in the three dimensions, at least three dimensions of health. And we may not be able to go to court with it, but there's a lot we can do it with it. We can go to Congress with it. We can go to the public with it. We can go to our communities with it, and we mobilize social movements around it. So I think it's incumbent upon us to learn about human rights law and how it applies. Because as we've seen from the statistics, just saying, oh yeah, rate disparities are bad in health and we ought to do something about it, that's not sufficient. So we have to think more and take this new approach and take seriously what a deep and entrenched problem this is and the kind of work that it's going to take, including work through new concepts to eliminate. Thank you.
Taking notes of all this good information my co-panelists have been sharing. Well, good morning, and I do want to apologize again. I didn't think it would be such a trek to get here. I live in Alexandria, Virginia, and I tell you, the snow is over, I think, but I'm not sure that Metro has recovered, so hopefully, and I see some of the other folks that were on the Metro and on the bus with me, so I'm glad we all got here safely. I'm really delighted to join you today for this symposium, and I would like to share a little bit of the work of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies on the status of health inequities affecting African Americans and other people of color, as well as possibilities for eliminating these inequities through this comprehensive health reform bill, which is still pending. And I, too, like Mara, think that we're going to get something. I don't know what it is, but we'll get something. On September 17th of this past year, the Joint Center released a study entitled The Economic Burden of Health Inequalities in the United States, and we released it during a health reform briefing at the National Press Club, which actually featured Secretary Kathleen Sebelius from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, as well as the researchers who conducted the study. And I brought a copy of it, and I'll just, you know, as I'm trying to become more green and sustainable, this is a picture of it here, or an example. It's the Economic Burden of Health Inequalities in the United States, and you can find it on our website at www.jointcenter.org. And we're really excited and proud about the work that was done. And just to tell you a little bit about the study, using data from existing federal health surveys, the study found that between 2003 and 2006, health inequalities in the United States people of color cost more than an extra $50 billion a year. The direct medical cost over the four-year period of the study amounted to a total of $229.4 billion. Now, please keep in mind that the price tag of $230 billion incurred between 2003 and 2006 reflects only the excess cost associated with health inequalities. That's just the extra cost, not the total cost. In other words, if you eradicate health inequalities, these excess costs would disappear. For African Americans alone, the direct medical expenditures due to health inequalities over this four-year period was $135.9 billion. And that's just for the African American community. A great deal of these direct medical expenditures due to health inequalities over the four-year period were for hospital costs. It is important to remember that because low-income people of color are disproportionately more likely to lack coverage, as you've heard from my colleagues here, they are also more likely to delay or forgo healthcare visits. By the time such vulnerable patients end up in a hospital setting, their respective health conditions have worsened to the point of requiring far more rigorous medical interventions and treatment regimes or regimens. This may help explain some of the soaring health-based medical care costs for African Americans and people of color. So I think to reverse this trend, we need comprehensive health care reform that is actually designed to eliminate health inequities, and you've heard a little bit about that this morning. And really the focus of what we do at the Joint Center is really focus more on the inequities versus the disparity. It creates a whole different context, sort of this new messages I think you were talking about. Disadvantaged people of color will be able to join other Americans in having a medical home with access to regular physician visits, preventative services, checkups, screen tests, prescription drugs, and dental care. These are the things that we expect in a comprehensive health care reform bill. So in short, eliminating health inequities for African Americans and certainly other people of color is not only the just and moral thing to do, it is also the most cost-effective thing to do to restore the nation's fiscal health. And I don't know if many of you know that one of the major reasons that people go into bankruptcy is because of medical costs. That's a statistic that's out there. I don't have the site for that, but that's been stated over and over again throughout this entire debate, and particularly in the context of our fiscal challenges that we're facing now in our nation. Now, let me say a few words about the indirect costs that result from health inequalities. These include the indirect cost of illness, such as lost productivity, lost wages, absenteeism, use of family leave for avoidable illnesses, and lower quality of life, as well as in the indirect cost of premature deaths, which are foregone wages, lost tax revenues, benefits and services for families of the deceased, and lower quality of life for family survivors. The researchers calculated that the indirect costs that result from health inequalities add up to more than $1 trillion from, again, 2003 to 2006. When you add the direct and indirect cost of health inequalities together, the grand total is more than $1.24 trillion. This study noted that this figure of $1.24 trillion over a four-year period is more than the annual gross domestic product, or GDP, of India, the world's 12th largest economy. So you might ask, who's paying for this, you know, this $1.24 trillion bill? Well, the answer is simple. All of us are, in our federal, state, and local tax bills, as well as bills for doctor visits, prescription drugs, and medical procedures. Yet eliminating racial health inequalities will do more than put the nation's fiscal house in order. It will also improve health status, as you've also heard about this morning, and outcomes for people of color from cradle to grave. So let me give you some information on why we especially need to improve health status and outcomes for African Americans. And I'm just going to sort of add to what I think Dr. Rubenstein has talked about. 17 years ago, in 1992, the Joint Center published what was at the time a pioneering document entitled A Health Assessment of Black Americans, which included noteworthy findings on black men and women's health. Although it is hard to believe, it was not until, and I want you to really listen closely to these dates, it was not until 1985 that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services published an official report on black and minority health. The Office of Minority Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services was established the following year in 1986. Now, moreover, the National Institute of Health, or NIH, did not adopt a policy that urged the inclusion of people of color and women in its clinical health research trials until 2 years later in 1987. 3 years later, which would be 1990, NIH established the first Office of Research on Women's Health. So we haven't come too far. I mean, we're still kind of, it seems, early in terms of just us understanding the importance of women and communities of color in our health needs. Furthermore, Congress, we're going to the legislative branch, did not mandate the inclusion of people of color and women in all NIH-supported clinical research until 1993. NIH is still attempting to overcome ongoing barriers to the recruitment of people of color and women as clinical research projects or clinical trials. One of the most pressing of such barriers is the continuation or the continued lack of racial and ethnic diversity among health researchers and practitioners. And we have an initiative that we've been working with former Secretary Louis Sullivan at HHS, who has really made this sort of his lifetime commitment to ensure that we have diversity within the health profession. Now I'd like to just say a few words about the parameters of heart disease in the U.S. and implications for cardiac-related data on health disparities, because this is probably the number one issue, I think, in terms of African Americans and certainly, in some cases, people of color. According to a recent study reported in the September 16, 2009 issue of the Journal of American Medical Association, black patients who suffer cardiac arrest in a hospital setting are much less likely to survive than white patients. Although survival after having a cardiac arrest in a hospital setting is historically low, survival rates for blacks were significantly lower at 25% versus 37% for whites. This amounts to about a 12% absolute difference in survival rates. According to a lead researcher, Dr. Paul Kahn, a cardiologist at St. Luke's Mid-American Heart Institute in Kansas City, this 12% absolute difference in survival is larger in terms of a racial disparity than survival disparities for any other medical condition. Although much of this disparity is believed to result from the hospitals in which Black patients receive care, there are often other factors at play. Some 32% of African Americans have high blood pressure or hypertension, a leading risk factor for heart disease, compared to 22.5% of whites in 2007. African American men are 30% more likely to die from heart disease than their white non-Hispanic males, according to a 2005 data on Office of Minority Health's website. And the disturbing disparity between heart-related death rates for Black males and white males in this country is not only stubbornly persistent, it also applies to females. Starting in 1997, the Joint Center has been publishing the Women of Color Health Data Book. Our third edition of the Women's Health Data Book was released in 2007. And as highlighted in this latest data book, African American women are more likely to be obese, more likely to have sedentary lifestyles, which is 55% of Black women reported they had no sedentary lifestyles between 1999 and 2001, which means they did not engage in any light physical activity for 10 minutes at a time. More likely to have high blood pressure, to have elevated levels of lead in blood, which is associated again with high blood pressure, more likely to die of heart disease, more likely to die of diabetes-related causes, and more likely to have a shorter life expectancy. So equally as alarming in the Joint Center's data book are some of the health indicators for Black adolescent females as well. So I won't go into all the details there, but I think you can kind of draw the picture and the conclusion of what I'm stating with some of the data. So again, it really goes back to the enactment of comprehensive health reform legislation is absolutely imperative if we are to truly eliminate the current health inequities facing African Americans and other people of color. The results of these inequities are now well documented in the higher premature death and disease rates among African Americans. And I'd like to just sort of quote that when Secretary Sebelius joined us at the press conference, she called these higher rates of premature death and diseases among African Americans, quote, quite stunning and shocking. At the Joint Center's briefing, she was just very eloquently when she talked about the fact that she emphasized that although we have become better at measuring these inequities, we have made little progress in reducing them. So she also pledged her personal commitment as well as that of the administration to eliminate such health disparities. So I've only been given a few examples of some of these many shocking and stunning health disparities that the Secretary was referring to at the briefing. But these inequities are serious and significant financial barriers that prevent access to health, that prevent access to quality health care services, from time-sensitive treatment options to preventative care that are aimed at a wide range of chronic and debilitating illness. So clearly, reducing the health disparities and enacting comprehensive health care reform is a top priority for this administration. Now it remains up to Congress, obviously, to send a bill to the President for his signature. I also want to just mention that at that health reform briefing at the press club, we also released another report that I brought a copy of to share with you. And it's called Congressional Healthcare Reform Proposals, Potential for Advancing Health Equity in America. And it looks like this. And what we basically did was did a comparison in terms of the specific health equity provisions within the pending health reform bills in the U.S. Congress. And again, you can get a copy of this on our website. And again, that is www.jointcenter.org. And it deals with both the House side as well as the Senate. So let me just say in closing that I wanted to kind of alert everyone to another recent report that was issued by the Commonwealth Fund showing that America ranks near the bottom of other industrialized nations in the numbers of preventable deaths. And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, that most of these deaths are preventable. These deaths are triggered by a range of illnesses and injuries, such as diabetes, epilepsy, stroke, influenza, ulcers, and pneumonia, that would usually not result in death at an early age. These are conditions where the right care and early care should be able to prevent an early death. So, for example, people should not be routinely dying of diabetes before they celebrate their 50th birthday. According to the Commonwealth Report, chronic illness account for more premature deaths in the United States than guns and auto fatalities. To quote Dr. Mark Pearson, who's the director of the Health Division at the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, on the U.S. healthcare system, and I quote, "Where it is good, it is very, very good. And where it is bad, it is horrid. Disadvantaged people of color are disproportionately represented among those Americans receiving care. Where it's bad, it's horrid." So I know that my time is short, and I'm certainly you all want to have some Q&A with the panel. But again, thank you for this opportunity, and thank you for your attention in having this opportunity to talk about this pivotal issue that affects people of color in this country. Thank you.
I want to thank all of our panelists. That was definitely a good wealth of information. We have time for at least one question. Does anyone have
time for more questions? We can do more questions.
Well, I'd like to start it off, if I may. Directed to you, Mara. I sit on the board of directors of Holy Cross Hospital in Silver Spring, Maryland, and it's part of the Trinity Health System. It's a not-for-profit hospital. There are thousands, I think, not-for-profit hospitals in the country. And not-for-profit hospitals, because of their tax-exempt status, are required to have community benefit programs. I know there are 92 different languages that are spoken by patients in Holy Cross Hospital. I don't know that there are translators for all of those languages, but I do know that the commitment of that hospital and the health system is significant in providing as many translators as possible. Can't we use the requirement for the provision of community benefits required by the IRS and to force not-for-profit hospitals to, as part of their commitment to the community, have translators where there's such a lack of
There are a number of laws, like the community benefit, like the old Hill-Burton requirements that exist, like Title VI. The problem really is the enforcement, and that's where we really have had the problems. So Title VI is mostly enforced by the Office for Civil Rights at HHS, and they just don't have the resources to do what they need to do. To enforce community benefit through the IRS, folks would have to bring challenges to the IRS, challenging a hospital's nonprofit or not-for-profit status for failing to meet the community obligations. There have been a couple of those cases, not on language access, but on providing charity care, and it's a real tough argument to make. What we've been trying to do, we're lawyers, but when we started the coalition, we actually took the enforcement issue sort of off the table. You know, we said we all know Title VI is there, we all know all these other laws are there, it's the elephant in the room, but they're not being enforced for a variety of reasons. How can we actually work together? And that's where we've tried to address some of the funding issues and some of the resource issues. But I completely agree, the law should be greater enforced, and these obligations should be taken more seriously. In large part, the nonprofits are actually better than a lot of the for-profits because of the patients coming in their doors. I mean, they sort of have to be more responsive, and it's also in many of their missions to serve the community. And so in large part, they're doing a better job than many, but still kind of falling short. And I can relate my own personal stories about Holy Cross, which I'll do not in the public forum. but I think that it is an issue. And so a lot of what we've tried to do also, in addition to looking at the legal side, is build up the database and the arguments about quality. And so there's been more focus in the country on patient-centered care and quality care. And that, to the extent that we can make sure that issues of language and race and ethnicity and other disparities are involved in that, it's very hard for someone to say, you know, I want to provide patient-centered care, but then I'm not going to, you know, care about my limited English proficient folks and speak to them. You know, if you're talking about doing patient-centered care, that means you take the patient as they come into your hospital and you meet their needs and you don't make them fit into your system. So I think it's using all these tools together. I'd love to see greater enforcement through the IRS, through HHS. The malpractice is another piece, and the reason we did this study is to sort of show that there are more cases. It's not just this $171 million settlement, but with this care, it was 2.5% of their claims, and that starts adding up to real money and real risks, and so that's another issue that we really are trying to sort of do it. So I agree. I think that the opportunities to do it, we just haven't seen, unfortunately, a lot of the legal hooks helping. We're trying with some of the other hooks as well.
Any other questions? We would need, in fact, we are recording this, so we need everyone to stand up and speak up so we can hear the question.
Okay, so one of my areas of interest in the past, and I guess this is kind of directed to Ms. Pierce, is traditional health beliefs, and maybe Ms. Sotomayor, maybe you can talk about this too. So in certain ethnic groups, there are traditional medicine beliefs that really affect receptivity to, you know, Western medicine. And is there any emphasis on that in your programs, and how is that being addressed?
There certainly is in the Indian Health Service program. I would have to restate that the majority of people working for the Indian Health Service are Native Americans. Now, we're in the General Counsel's office, we have preferential hiring, but we still have a few Native attorneys. But I think it's really important to understand that the people running the program are Indian. There's huge respect for Native medicines, and there's a huge Native medicine practice. And by that, I mean each individual tribe has its own specific traditional medicine practices, and that goes from sweat lodges to specific herbal remedies to specific things that wouldn't even be understood because larger populations are so unfamiliar with some of these practices. And when we negotiate contracts with the tribes to transfer the funding that the IHS would have spent, we, in almost all of the tribal contracts, they're called Indian Self-Determination Act contracts, have a traditional medicine paragraph stating that the tribe is going to do this, and it's going to get Federal Tort Claims Act coverage. Now, this is something that we fought with the Department of Justice on for years, because the Department of Justice is primarily non-Native and is very conscientious about litigation risk. Mm-hmm. They make the final Federal Tort Claims Act coverage decisions. So we have a few levels. We're the first level. Then the General Law Division and the Department of Health and Human Services is the second level, but the first level for FTCA determinations in reality, and then the Department of Justice, of course, because these claims are heard in the federal court system. So we are the wall to support the Indian Health Service and to say not only is it in statutes and treaties and historic practice, but it's the right thing to do to support people in their traditional practices. You know, we weren't using it's Western medicine because it's the traditional and first Western medicine, but we weren't using the Anglo-European medical practices up until the last 150 years. So how can we tell people that they can't use their own practices?
And this is a much broader issue as well. I mean, you hear about the term cultural competency and trying to help educate healthcare providers about different cultural issues that come into play. I think it's more important to sort of develop what's called cultural sensitivity or humility, because you're never going to get a provider to understand all of the different cultural issues of all the patients they treat. But rather, they have to be understanding and receptive to talking with their patients about what those beliefs are, what those complementary and alternative medicine practices are, and how that may impact the patient's understanding of their diagnosis, their decision about treatment, their decision about how to do, et cetera. So it is a much bigger issue. Language is one piece of the puzzle of sort of cultural competency, but it is certainly a much broader issue, and it does affect disparities as well, because you've got lots of patients who won't follow through with the treatment plan because they don't understand it, or it isn't explained to them in a way that they can reconcile with their cultural beliefs, and they'll just, you know, say, forget it, I don't, you know, respect what that doctor said or what that nurse said, and then, you know, there's a lot of other repercussions that can come about and exacerbation of their condition, when if providers took the time and talked to patients and helped them understand, you know, the benefits and the risks, you know, but at least it's a conversation and it's an informed decision, as opposed to just assuming that someone's going to do what the doctor says because it's, you know, the right way and it doesn't address any cultural issues or alternative medicine issues.
I think additionally it's important to know that traditional medicine is not the same as complementary and alternative medicine. They're usually grouped together by larger groups. They're not grouped together for the Indian Health Service. I mean, we wouldn't see traditional medicine as an alternative medicine.
We don't have any more questions. I actually do have a quick question. There has been, many have said that with immigrant communities growing in the U.S. and many have, you know, complaining about illegal immigrants coming in, a lot of people have been, it's been sort of this assumption that they're using up the system, that they're taking over and using uninsured, running to the hospital and using the system. And then there's many that have said that, no, it actually isn't. They're quite not running to the hospital. And I want you, can anyone sort of address that issue? Has there been research to show that this, you know?
There's actually been research. There's been a number of studies that show in general immigrants are actually using less healthcare, costing less to the healthcare system, are on average healthier, and therefore can help balance out sort of, you know, costs in health reform. And actually another study was just released this week or last week. So there's continuing research. So that's one of the myths that's very, very hard to overcome, that immigrants are using too much. And it's been a real problem in health reform because at least the Senate was going to exclude all immigrants from even buying with their own money into the private plans in the exchange. And so there's still efforts to include immigrants, both because it's the right thing to do from the human rights perspective, from the legal perspective, from the moral perspective, but also it actually can help balance out some of the cost and be a cost saver because they are generally healthier and use less services.
That actually brings up another point, though, which is there is this association that if you're talking about language issues, this is not my view, but if you're talking about language issues, you automatically bring in the anti-immigrant view. How do you deal with that politically? If you want more funding or if you want legislation, how are you going to go against that political wall that I would think exists there? I mean, even though the Democrats are in power.
Well, it's been interesting, and we've been very cautious about how we talk about our language access work. And we make sure that we're not doing too much work, even though my organization works on immigrant issues, and a lot of our partners in the coalition do both. We sort of don't together go in and talk about immigrant issues and language access in the same, you know, Hill visit or policy discussion, because it does get, you know, tainted. As much as we want to advance immigrants as well, we sort of realize if we're going to advance language access, we've got to do it a little bit differently. But we also can show, based on the demographics and census data, that there are lots of citizens, both naturalized citizens and U.S.-born citizens, who are limited English proficient. And so we sort of make the argument in that regard, and then lots of, you know, asylees and refugees who come into the meeting. And so we've been able to sort of make the case that this is about access, quality, et cetera, and, you know, using some of the demographic data we can help with. I actually did, I'm a lawyer, I'm not a number cruncher, but I was able to crunch some basic census numbers that about two-thirds of folks who are LEP are actually complete, you know, here as citizens or documented immigrants. So we're not really talking about a huge proportion of undocumented immigrants. Now, do I advertise that a lot? No. But, you know, it is something in the arsenal that we can help make the case.
Can I also just say, I think you're raising a larger question, and that's the poverty of our debate. Back in the presidential elections, President Obama famously said that health care is a right. But President Obama also went out of his way, and this was a joint session of Congress, that undocumented people would not be in his health care plan. And everybody's working pragmatically to get health care through. Has to buy into the notion that we're going to exclude undocumented people, and no one wants to be caught saying, oh, yeah, it should be in too, because you lose. But there needs to be another voice. It's fine for people trying to work the Hill to say, oh, no, we're not going to touch that issue. But there's a real absence of a voice in this country that says human rights and human dignity cannot distinguish by status. And there is no voice. There's almost nobody talking in this country. And it ought to start right here in the law schools. It ought to start in places where people say, if we're a nation that takes human rights seriously, we cannot go on and say, we're going to let people die, we're going to deny them a fundamental aspect of health care because they're undocumented. Or even if they don't have the documents that we like. We need to go a lot further, and it is quite scandalous, actually, that there is no voice in this country for human right to health care, regardless of status. And I'm not criticizing my friends who are doing health care lobbying. They're in a difficult place, but there needs to be someone else, a lot of someone else, who's talking about this issue.
And I will say that's other folks in my organization do that, and we've been trying to make that voice heard, and we just keep getting deaf ears. And we've been working a lot with our colleagues working on immigrant benefits to try to make that argument and to say it is about the human right. We're having some success in states, so that we're actually doing some state-based work and trying to get state laws or amendments to constitutions saying there's a human right to health. Because if you buy into the human right to health, you don't have to talk about the immigrant issue. It's just covered. Mm-hmm. Same thing with kids. When we were working on kids' health insurance last year, we were saying all kids should get insurance. And that was the mantra when we were doing reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program. It didn't work as well. But so I think there's starting to be some greater recognition of the human rights principles, and unfortunately we're just meeting a lot of resistance from the policymakers, and so we just need to do, you're right, have a lot more folks and a lot more louder folks in higher positions that can get their voices heard.
Another thing that strikes me is the listing of disparities, and I'm just looking at the American Indian ones here, but there's one up, black-white disparities. Can we really lump all of those different issues together, all of those causes together? I mean, the one that would jump out to me, that it, especially in terms of what the solutions are to eradicating some of these disparities, and the one that would jump out to me would be homicide rates, for instance. I mean, is that something you can directly get at through just healthcare reform? Do you see where I'm going with this? As opposed to something like, breast cancer or something like that. Some of these seem like you might have to approach them in different ways.
Right. I tried to emphasize that we have to take a holistic approach. That's why we're doing so much with partnerships. We partner not only with private and other federal departments, but also with the states. And we try to partner with the Department of Education and with the Department of Labor and private entities to bring them to the reservations to increase the job opportunities. When you're looking at homicide, almost across the board, you're looking at a problem where there's a lack of opportunity, usually a lack of economic opportunity. It is linked to healthcare, but every healthcare issue that you see a stat for on that sheet is linked to a solution that needs a holistic approach. I absolutely agree. Healthcare reform is not going to lower the homicide rate, because the access to services, or even giving better services, is not going to work if there's still no job opportunity.
There actually is a provision in the House bill that talks about the social determinants of health. And when you think about the social determinants of health, that's a much broader framework that deals with issues of jobs, education, crime. And so that's a piece where there are communities now, particularly with women public health across this country, who are really looking at that and really looking at what are those root causes that are causing some communities to have much worse health status than others. And it's beyond sort of just whether or not you have access to a physician. It goes much deeper than that. And part of the reason that our framework is really around the equity piece versus the disparities piece, because you get stuck on the medical side when you talk about disparities, and when you start talking about equity, then you can dig deeper into access to foods and nutritional kinds of things. I mean, those are the things in terms of helping people change their lifestyles. When you think about things like the First Lady's, coming out with Let's Move initiative campaign, obesity is a major issue, but it's not a medical issue. And so those are the kinds of things that I think are going to make a difference when we start looking at the social determinants. That's what's going to turn these numbers around. So I appreciate you bringing up that point.
I'm just going to add, the health reform is it's a big piece, but it's still just a piece. I mean, it was started under the pretense that we only have X amount of dollars to spend. So it wasn't true health reform. It's mostly health insurance reform, and even that isn't going as far as a lot of us think it needs to go. It's necessary, it hopefully will still happen, but the social determinants of health, health issues beyond health care issues and sort of moving backwards, it's critical. So taking care of health insurance reform or health care access moves us somewhat down the path, but not nearly as far as we need to go. And this bill, even though there's good stuff in it, is certainly not everything that lots of us would want to see. And it doesn't really address disparities very well at all. I mean, it's really, really pretty poor. Despite all of what lots of us have been working, there actually was a national working group on health reform and health disparities that we helped work with. And the briefing that they did, the savings that you can get, the better quality of life, et cetera, none of that was making a dent. So there's these tiny little language access provisions, social determinants of health provisions, little tiny pieces here and there. They could have done so much more, should have done so much more based on all this research. And we just can't get that heard.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank all of you. This has been great.